afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today, I should say you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and I'm so happy today to have Jillian here in the studio. We're taping the show. It's the 30th of January, 2025, everyone out there. We've got Jason behind the glass. And Jillian, thanks so much for coming down. You're an artist in residence here on campus with the LSWA, the Lloyd Hall Scholar. Well, actually, it's got a new name, which I just realized is escaping me, but it's
the Lloyd Scholars Writing and Arts, I believe.
So it is LSWA. Okay.
It's still LSWA. Okay. Yeah. I'm learning all the various four-letter acronyms for everything as I'm here. It's a deep dive.
I mean, seriously, because you said, I'll just meet you at the station. And I think I sent you the SAB. I hope I was like, please have sent Jillian the street number as well.
You did. You sent me the address. Okay. You sent me the number. And, you know, I'm really using the hell out of Google Maps right now. So it's all good.
And you know Ann Arbor now because you are so busy while you're here. You're moving all around campus.
Totally.
Like meeting with students everywhere, like on North Campus as well with Phoebe Glickner and LSWA students,
totally
minor and writing students Sweetland. For Sweetland.
Exactly. It's everything. It's really awesome. It's very immersive.
I hope. How's it going?
It's going really great. I came in with like sort of keyed up to 10 in terms of like I need to be so prepared, and like being prepared is great, but now that I've done a few and I'm seeing how they go and like seeing how students are responding, it's like that tension is starting to come down, which is a lovely thing. And now it's like, let's just relax and like interact with people and trust that the material that I've prepared is gonna be enough and it'll land, or if it doesn't, like I learned something from that too and just like roll with it. But everybody's so nice and the students are so keen. Like they're just like, they were describing themselves last night. They're like, we're really whimsical. I'm like, okay. And it's true. There's a lot of like gameness for doing a lot of activities because I'm a comics person. So having like, I'm visiting with music club. I'm visiting with creative writing. I'm visiting with the board game club. And it's like, well, how do these things apply? So I'm making everybody do drawing exercises, whether whatever they've got me in for has anything to do with drawing or not. I mean, I think it's a viable skill no matter what practice that you've got, like actually putting pen to paper, making marks, all of that stuff. So but sometimes, you know, early on I was like, is this going to be justifiable? Are people going to push back? Absolutely not. Everybody's like, yeah, we'll draw stupid shapes. We'll make scribbles and turn them into monsters. We'll participate. So everybody's been a super great sport.
And it seems like when you're actually, I love this. Thank you so much, Jillian, for coming here, talking about it like this too. And not only talking about it, but doing it, like being out there with all the students. Because it's like when you're drawing and you're trying things, even if you're not someone who identifies as, I'm, you know, a good sketch, you know, I can draw. What you're saying is I think inviting everyone in.
Yeah.
And your brain works differently when you're right, like drawing with your hand.
Totally.
Right?
Or I mean, that idea of identifying as an artist or as somebody who can draw is kind of part of the problem where, you know, I borrow heavily from the work of Linda Barry, who's just like, she's the best.
Love her.
Well, and when I was a kid, I read her work like probably too young. Like would go to the library and just go to the comics section, which at that time was like 7 comedy writing books. And half of it was just like Dave Barry-esque stuff.
Yes.
And Kathy comics, which, you know, getting little kids to read Kathy is hilarious. But I was like, I just craved comics.
You're like anything. You had like exhausted the Peanuts compendium.
Oh, this is it. Which is amazing. But it's like, it's not dense, you know, in terms of the storytelling
in like third grade, like elementary.
Totally.
Yeah.
But I found 2 Linda Barry books that just like blew my young mind. And they were sort of like, you know, they got into like young person trauma in a way that was like cracked me open. One of these has recently been brought back into print after being out of print.
That's so important.
Because I hoarded my copies for ages. And the other one's called, I think it's called My Perfect Life. And they're both like Garfield sized. You know how Garfield books are sort of like
oblong?
Yes, or so? Exactly. It's like a wide rectangle. And these were that format of sort of 3-panel comics. And they just, they're incredible. They're so, so, so good. So, you know, later in life when I sort of rediscovered Linda Barry, like you sort of forget for a while and then come back into the awareness that this is a thing that exists. It's not just a thing I saw when I was a kid. You know, like it's like, did I dream that?
Some things are.
Yeah. But then now she's making all these incredible books about creativity and education. She has a book called Syllabus.
Love that. It's what so it is. Useful.
Picture This. And of course, her incredible Making Comics, which is like actually a comics making course step by step. And which they also do at La Soie, like their comics making course, they're following that, bringing other stuff in as well. But those exercises are so incredible and profound. So that's been a good jumping off point. But Linda Barry really gets into it in that book of, you know, when we were kids, we all made marks. And before you learn to write, you're just drawing and like making letter characters and making drawings. It's all the same kind of mark making. And at a certain point, like the judgment, the eyes from the outside come in and say, this is good, this is bad. And then your drawing moves into the margins. And now you just do writing, which is, you know, scholarly and it's following, it's rule following. And like none of that's a bad thing, but the organization of thought that's required to do writing as a translation of thought or a translation or dictation is so different than just drawing for fun and watching your hand make marks and, you know, just like even doodling when you're on the phone. You know, the old, I'm old enough to have had like a rotary phone that had like a long curly cord and you'd sit on the phone and there'd be a scratch pad by the phone and you'd just make spirals or you'd make little circles or you'd make cross hatching or you'd do whatever you do. Like, who cares what it was? But, you know, that was just the natural output of like brain to hand.
It was. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting too, because I wonder, because you said, well, now then you only make certain marks after a certain point.
Yeah.
But now it even seems like handwriting is probably changing for young people.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Especially the very young, right?
Yeah. Oh, no. A funny thing, actually, I love typography as much as it seems like I'm really taking a dump on handwriting or like making letter characters, but I love fonts and like design and typography, etc. So I did... I tried for a minute to do TikTok. The account still exists. If y'all want to follow it, you can look forward to me never posting. But it's jilliang.com with D-O-T-C-O-M spelled out. I did a little video series about cursive writing, which is something that's also on the outs. And one of them like blew up huge.
No.
And suddenly I got this call from a radio station being like, you've been cited in a National Geographic article about cursive writing. And I was just like, how did this happen? Like, I'm not an authority.
Jillian, you are on your way.
Go big time.
Like, this is like, there is no looking back now.
Oh yeah. My new career. But it was nuts. And they had me on a radio program like CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, were like, come in and talk about cursive writing. And they played the TikTok on the radio, which I was like, I can't think of a better example of like media's not computing, because it's just like the only audio in it is like, you know how TikTok works. It's like you use trending audio, you use all the different things that make the video go viral. So it's like there's literally, it's a visual video and you're playing just like weird background music and that crappy automated voice going like, solving the mystery of the cursive G. It's demented. But anyway, I love cursive writing. All that to say, if you're out there listening, learn how to cursive writing if it's being phased out, because it's worth it.
Yeah, because it does something different to your brain.
Totally.
And just like you said, like what were our release, our output, it changes things, doesn't it?
Yeah, big time.
So for your two books, goodness, I don't even think I've mentioned it yet.
Okay. I don't think so. We just dived into it.
We just started, and we didn't talk about the talking heads at the top of the program. Thanks for choosing the songs for today.
Oh, my pleasure.
It was just such a great way to kick it off here. So the two books on the table, Shirley and Jamila Save Their Summer and Shirley and Jamila's Big Fall.
Yeah.
I just want to say these are graphic novels for young readers. It's I think the official was it
middle grade.
Yeah, middle grade. Dial books for young readers.
Yeah.
Middle grade.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm loving them.
Oh, good. Thank you. I'm glad.
Because what were you going to say, Jillian?
Oh.
They
oh, I don't know.
No, about the... Because, well, sorry, I didn't mean...
Oh, the middle grade category is sort of like the 8 to 12 pocket, where, you know, you're reading on your own fully, you know, as a kid, and but you're not yet into that sort of teen zone where you're starting to want to, like, read more adult stuff, and, like, the content has to change sort of with your developmental rate. So this is, in my opinion... kind of a sweet spot of childhood is the 8 to 12 zone. Sometimes it's when kids are most annoying because they're really trying on their future adult personality.
But back and forth.
But back and forth. It's like also such an alive time in terms of having your own thoughts, forming your own opinions, making a bunch of decisions about, like, you know, how you want to be in the world and how to express yourself and what growing up is.
Is that why you were attracted to this time period, this audience?
Totally. It's some of my favorite reading in my life was books targeted at this age group.
Because you dedicate this book to Ramona, I think.
I do. And to Beverly Cleary. I wish I would have pared that dedication down. That's one of these things. Once a book goes to print, the things that later embarrass you, you're like, well, that's out there and I can't change it. But yeah, it's Beverly Cleary. If you haven't read the Ramona books, like, run out and do so. Judy Blume. Also, Louise Fitzhugh, who wrote Harriet the Spy. Harriet the Spy was such a formative book for me. And you know, the history of Harriet the Spy is super interesting as well. And Louise Fitzhugh as an author, who was lived in New York, was a secret lesbian who went and, like, cross-dressed. I mean, they would have called it cross-dressing at the time. Who knows how she'd identify now.
Right.
But, like, at the time, in terms of, like, available identities, she, like, went under the name Willie and, like, went to, like, secret New York, you know, queer bars. And there was a whole secret queer kids publishing scene that, you know, if it had been outed at the time, those people would have been blackballed. Like, what would have happened? We'd have been without so many books. Maurice Sendak, like, the list goes on. And these two publishers, whose names I'm forgetting, one is Ursula something, but they were, like, also secret queers who, like, fostered this incredible environment of kids' books. But, you know, going into Harriet the Spy, so much of kids' writing was prescriptive, like etiquette books for kids on how to be, like, a productive citizen and, like, a good future husband or wife, like that kind of, you know, 50s specificity. And Harriet the Spy was sort of is lauded as the first big book for that middle grade age group, where it's, like, kids as persons, as people who, like, have negative feelings and, like, all the characters in that
conflict.
Yeah. And they all defy stereotypes. They all have a lot to say and they're pissed off and they're shouting about it. They're not being good little kids who are seen and not heard.
And so this is inspiring to you
because big time.
It meant something to you as a kid,
yep.
It sounds like, too. Because at the top of, like, when we first started talking, Jillian, you had said, well, maybe you found the Linda Berry sooner than you should have in some ways. And, like, because these are the exact books that you're kind of talking about that there weren't a lot of. Like, Harriet the Spy is, like... it's not comics. There are some drawings in the book, as I remember.
Yeah.
Same with Ramona. Maybe some of the chapter title headings or so, or maybe a
totally
sketch.
Just like in illustration jargon, that's spot illustrations for the keeners outside.
Thank you. That's what we need. We need. And teach me too, please, because that's always, want to learn. So this is part of, like, why this, you felt like, oh, this is something that I could, let's take a short break. I will ask you this upon return.
Okay.
Everybody, you're listening to Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today in the studio, Jillian Kurtz. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're tuning in now, you're just in time because today Jillian Gertz is here in the studio on Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Before we get back to the conversation with Jillian, I'm going to read the short bio that's on the back of Shirley and Jamila Saved Their Summer, the first book out with Dial Penguin Graphic for middle grade readers by Jillian Gertz. Jillian Gertz is an illustrator, writer, and cartoonist based in Toronto. Her illustrations and comics can be found in a number of collections, including the autobiographical anthology, The Secret Loves of Geek Girls. Shirley and Jamila Saved Their Summer is her first graphic novel. Follow her on, well, you know what? Instagram at Jillian G DOTCOM. I love that. You did say earlier that that was your TikTok handle too. So it's all spelled out, folks. So anyway, okay. And now we also have on the table, since publication of the first in the series, the second in the series, Shirley and Jamila's Big Fall. And when we were off air, you mentioned you used to do radio. I want to get back to that before we get back to the book.
Sure.
Just so we don't lose this moment. I want to hear the story.
Yeah.
When were you a DJ? When were you doing radio?
It was ages ago now. I want to say maybe like 2003 or 4 or 5, somewhere in there, in Lethbridge, Southern Alberta, which is ironically where I live again now. I lived there, lived in Toronto for about 15 years and then like ended up moving back. So in Toronto is kind of a lie at this point.
Well, thank you for seeing the bio.
No, but it's all good. I sort of split my time between the two places because I still have like a huge community of pals in Toronto and like have some business stuff that still happens out there. So I go back and forth a bit. But
you're in Alberta.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild. But when I was initially in Lethbridge, they have a great college radio station. And I never went to that school either. I had a radio station at the college radio of a university I didn't attend.
You can do that here.
You can do it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And I just always thought it would be fun. And it was. I had a show called The Auditorium. And I just played this was the heyday of like early like bleepy indie music, and I was very like Fiery Furnaces, Architecture in Helsinki, The Deers. That was sort of the pocket, you know, New Pornographers. That was very much my energy.
Nico Case Forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nico Case Forever. So, you know, that was my musical heyday.
Oh, and so you were spinning then, and Oh, did you ever get to see the Fiery Furnaces?
Yes, I saw them in Australia. They were awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you were you, is that something, one of your values, like to travel the world and draw and make, or what?
I mean, I love traveling. It is something that I really enjoy. And that has been a nice thing about living in a smaller city now, instead of like Toronto was so great because it's a real gateway to so many places and it's a destination itself. Living where I live now in a much, much smaller city that's like 300% more affordable suddenly means I can afford to do more of the travel that I always wanted to do. When I was in Toronto, the cost of living was so high that I often ended up not, like, I traveled less, but I was in a city that was vibrant, so I didn't miss it as much, but I didn't go as many places. And now I travel a lot more now that I'm in a smaller town. Ironically, the travel is much more difficult and irritating because we have like a crappy little hopper airport, but that's fine. The difficulty of it is countered by the fact that I can afford to do it now.
Where's your next trip? Just being nosy.
Oh, when I get back from Ann Arbor, I'm going to Mexico like a week later. Then I'm going to Toronto in March and I'm going to Alaska in May.
In Alaska for seeing things or for like work with your graphic
book stuff,
novels?
Actually.
Book stuff, yeah.
There's the most incredible comics camp that happens in Juneau, run by two Aaron and Pat of Alaska Robotics. They're just the best people. Anybody listening to this, if you're a comics maker of any stripe, apply to go to this camp. It's the best thing in the planet.
It's for all ages.
Not kids. It's for adult, like, comics professionals.
I see. Okay.
But I would say, when I say of all stripes, I mean, like, if you have a indie webcomic or you like sell at zine fairs, you're just as welcome as like Marvel, DC writers who are also present at it. So the cast of characters in terms of attendees that show up is like the creme de la creme, while also being a really wide expanse of like the type and nature of the work and the stage of career that everybody's
at. But that sounds like the genuine world of like what you would want to be part of.
And 100%.
To hope you could be, that's part of, that's my community. That's
totally. It's, I mean, both my books published during the pandemic. So right. Like that's when they came out. I worked on them before, and like July 2020 is when my first book came out and the second one like a year and a half later. So like I never had launch parties. I missed out on all of the community building aspects of suddenly being a published author. And one of the first times I really felt like, oh, you actually made a book was going to Alaska and getting to like feeling like I was like, oh, these people are my peers, not my heroes anymore. Like they can be both. But to be amongst a bunch of people who like very much know what I've been through and I know what they've been through in terms of, you know, just the trials and tribulations of creating, which is not insignificant. Yeah, it's super duper duper awesome. That camp is dynamite. With most people who present,
what's it called again?
It doesn't really have a name, but the Alaska Robotics is the name of the people that put it on. This
perfect.
Pat and Aaron, they're just incredible in Juneau. I mean, there's only so many things.
If you Google that, you will find it.
You'll find it. You'll find it. Sorry, I have to.
Oh.
Bless me. Oh, there we go.
No. Oh, yeah.
I'm like, all, something's coming.
All a clear.
Burp.
All
thank
clear.
You. Oh. Yeah.
Well, when you say trials and tribulations, Jillian, were you talking about like life as a like an artist, as a maker, or even navigating the world of taking your work to the into the public eye?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. It's the fact that everything came out during lockdown meant that the public eye stuff didn't feel that stressful for me. Mm-hmm. I sort of felt insulated from it. It felt a little like hyper real or not real at all. It's just like, oh, there's media coming in and reviews are coming in. But like I was not out there to meet anybody. And like I would hear from my friends saying like, oh, we read your book and we liked it, which friends are always going to say that. So you can't trust them. But just like during that time, I was like,
it's
with
really
one
good,
person and
Jillian.
A dog. Oh, thank
it's
you.
Really, it's, I can't wait to read, finish this one and get to the second one too.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But back to your story.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Listen, if you're going to interrupt for gratuitous praise, I'll always take a beat, you know? but in terms of the making of it, it was, you know, I don't like to sugarcoat it because creative work is rewarding and awful at the same time. But making it had absolutely hellish moments, especially the first book. I mean, the second too. It's for me specifically, I'm recently in the great trend of people in their mid-40s getting diagnosed with ADHD, have got that exciting feather in my cap now. But like looking back, it's no surprise. It's no surprise at all. Like, it's just ludicrous, but like, you know, women are underdiagnosed, blah, blah, blah. That's a whole other podcast, but
we can do that one.
Yeah. basically thinking back on it, it's because I have such, you know, ADHD oriented working habits. In order to get the work done under the deadline, I really went into sort of like a self-torture mode where I would just go into my studio. I had a fantastic shared studio in Toronto with some of the best people on earth and would go in maybe like 11, between 11 and 2, like a.m., p.m. kind of thing, and stay till like 2, 3, 4 in the morning because I had to like just waste time for my requisite amount of time. I had to like spend 4 to 6 hours pushing papers around, doing everything but the work at hand before I could get into it. And then I'd find some flow and then I wasn't willing to give it up. So like, it's just like rubber grip of, yeah, yeah. T's just like pointing violently at me right now in agreement. I think the visual should be communicated, but like the agreement is so there. But it's, so once I had any sort of flow, I didn't want to give it up. So I'd just work until I couldn't work anymore, which was often 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. And like, 7 days a week. Like if I took a day off, that felt too indulgent because it's just the specter of this deadline was so high pressure. And for the type of work that I prefer to do, having these long deadlines of like, oh, you've got 18 months to complete a huge project is truly a nightmare.
Yeah.
So that part was really, really challenging. It's, there's some quote out there about like, I hate writing, but I love to have written. And I very much identify with this. I love to have made a book. I don't love making it all the time. Mm-hmm. Like maybe even most of the time. I'm hoping to get on like ADHD meds, which I think will probably change my life. But in terms of my relationship to like the pain and pleasure of actually sitting down and focusing on any one thing for more than 15 minutes, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And when you're saying writing too, that means because the interplay of text and image for mm-hmm. you, because that's how you're writing is
totally.
The compositional with the image.
Yep.
Is the visual driving it often, or are you also hearing some of the, like, are you,
it's both. Yes.
Both
yes. And, like, yes. Both. All. It's. When I did my first book, I very much drew and wrote at the same time, like just really loosely. I've always identified as an artist first because I was good at drawing at a really young age. Like that was something that was rewarded for me very young. It's like, you're good at this. You like doing this. We're going to buy you stuff to make that easy. Like I would get markers and art supplies for my birthdays and things like that because this was a clear interest that I enjoyed. Awesome. Only as an adult thinking back, did I identify that through my entire childhood, I wasn't just drawing pictures. I was always making comics. I would have like
a narrative.
Yes, always. And like make characters, give them names, put them in a world, make them interact with each other. These two fall in love. These two get married. We jump ahead a few years. Now they have kids. Now I follow their story. Like since I was as early as I can remember, and only as an adult did I identify that as writing. Yeah, I just didn't think of it like that at the time. I was just goofing around. I was just drawing. And so now to be like, oh, well, do I have any storytelling skills? Who knows? Like truly arrogance is what allowed me to like even apply for grants or try to get a book publishing. Because I was just like, I can probably do it because I didn't think about it as writing. If I had, I would have, you know, self-selected my way out of that path.
Well, thank goodness for the arrogance then.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes like that, sometimes to be a maker, you have to believe that you're the one to do it.
Well, it just didn't have any stakes for me, which was a good thing. It's sort of actually kind of the opposite of arrogance is sort of like true ignorance. Where I was just like, the writing part will probably work out, but I know I can do the drawing.
It's probably fine.
Yeah, it's probably going to be fine. I can get a little like, can I do this? I don't know. I guess I'll try it and find out. And that's served me pretty well in my life. Every once in a while, it's left me truly high and dry. But like, those are very overbalanced by the times that it like coincidentally worked out.
Yeah. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back to talk more today with Jillian Gertz. Her book's on the table, Shirley and Jamila Save Their Summer and Shirley and Jamila's Big Fall. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Jillian Gertz is here. She's in the songs. And Jillian, you're also in a band now. A cover band?
I am in a band. I've always been like a bit of a karaoke show off.
And it's a thing.
Oh, yeah.
You have your songs then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I come from like actually an opera singing background on my dad's side. I'm from a family, not a personal background, but my whole dad's side of the family are like singers. But I didn't grow up doing that. But the karaoke thing was sort of my chance to stretch my legs. And then in the last couple years, I guess it was just last year, some pals of mine were like, we're doing this Ramones cover band, like a one night thing. Do you want to sing in it? And I was like, yeah, sure. I've never been in a band before. And like, I mean, a nice thing about a cover band is you really can learn every aspect of the song going in. And Ramone's songs are like, what, 2-3 chords? So we breeze in, had our first rehearsal, and at the end of it, everybody was just like, that was really good. Also, this is, I'm so much more of a theater person than like a music person. I'm calling them rehearsals. Band practice would be the parlance of like the cool punk people. But like, I'm not that. I'm just like a big nerd who like, we put on like Ramone's costumes. Like, I wear a wig, so does everybody, and we, like, get up there. But, like, everybody
Please share a couple of photos, if you don't mind. Could I
sure,
post one
sure.
on Living Writers
Absolutely.
Later?
Okay, absolutely. But, like, you know, the other people in the band are, like, real musicians, so they're really doing the heavy lifting, and I just have to learn lyrics and come in and not screw up too badly and be an idiot in front. And that's my wheelhouse, being an idiot in a microphone. I'm doing it right now. It's perfect.
No. You are absolutely lovely. That
lovely
sounds
great. Idiot. No, just kidding.
Okay, let's get back to Shirley and Jamila
sure.
here, because I feel like we've talked about so many good things so far, but not really like the story mm-hmm. of how Shirley Bones came to you and the why of it for you. And so, because I don't know, connected to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Shirley Bones.
No coincidence. Yeah. It's, excuse me, I'm just like burping my guts out here.
It's the Duncan.
Yeah, it's the Duncan. We don't have this kind of rich stuff in Canada.
Oh, yeah, because everything's Tim Hortons.
Oh, yeah, truly the worst coffee on earth. Yeah, Duncan's amazing. But, you know, anyway, in answer to your question, Sherlock Holmes, Shirley Bones. Yeah, it's I talk a little bit more about this in depth in some of the like the presentations I'm going to do. If this comes out in time, people can come to see the Lissois various talks. But a bunch of things were sort of happening simultaneously that made these books happen in a way that it would have been impossible to plan. It's just the confluence of little moments. But around the time I was coming up with the ideas for this, which was probably like, I don't know, 2014, 2015, I was reading a lot of Sherlock Holmes. And I love Sherlock Holmes, but you're always taken out of, or I am always taken out of the story by how racist they are and how sexist they are. And like, just, you know, the wackadoodle values of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which like, look into it. If you want to really go down a wild rabbit hole, look at some of his belief systems. They get nutty. But also just Victorian England is a fundamentally super racist, sexist society. Fine.
That's the setting.
Yeah, that's it. So I was really enjoying the amazing stuff about Sherlock Holmes. And there's so much. I mean, Sherlock Holmes is the most iterated character in like the history of English literature. Like there's so many various remakings, retellings, da, da, da. It's every 3 to 5 years, there's something new because there's so much meat on the bone and there's so many like fun story elements. And there's like something about it that's just so interesting to us and to me at that time. And I was like, well, what if I could retell this story with my interest in middle grade writing in mind? What if it was two girls? And what if it's in Toronto instead of London? Because Toronto's a real parallel in a lot of ways for London, like also both British colonies at a certain level. But also Toronto's where I was living and I was just like so in love with being there. So it was like, I want this to really have a sense of place in the same way that the Sherlock books are very much in London. They talk about the smog and the grayness and the slush. And like one nice day is like the biggest thrill for everybody. Like, you know, it had place in it. And I wanted that here, too, instead of just like in a fantasy world or like generic city USA. You know, I wanted it to be set in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Because it's such a vibrant city, like you said. It's a multicultural city. It's historically
the most multicultural city in the world. It's truly an excellent city. And there's stuff that's pretty tough about it. But like, it's awesome. And I love living there. I was drawing in my sketchbook the one day, and a friend of mine, I think, had made a joke about like Sherlock Holmes, Shirley Bones, made sort of a reference. Like, I had this trench coat that was very that, and she'd sort of identified like, this is your Shirley Bones look. And
because you already had the name.
Well, it's like it just kind of came up organically with like with chit chat. And because if I'd thought too much about it, I think I would have talked myself out of it. Like, why Bones instead of Holmes or something with H or whatever? Like, it's just like so much creative work is a dumb joke taken to the ultimate limit. And this is that. So it was just like, oh, it's an inside joke with my friend. How funny to take it to the next step. And then how funny to take it to the next step. And how funny to even go a little bit further. And then you're in too deep and it's done. Like, it's...
it's your thing.
It's your thing, now.
For a while.
Yeah. So I had been just sketching and I made the character of Shirley Bones. Like, I did a drawing and I'm like, oh, I know who this is. And I was like, oh, she's fun. And when I drew her, she was a little more, like, teen-aged looking. So, but like... it was there. I'm like, the hair with the big flip up and sort of that like pointy mid-century nose. Yes. And like this really kind of stylized look. I was like, that's a fun character. It's a drawing that I like right away, which can be a rare thing because we're so harsh and judgmental of our own creations. You draw something and it's just like, oh, what did I do? I've humiliated myself. I felt like that, not at all. So I was like, this is something I want to go forward with. And then at the time, I'd also been lucky enough to, through a friend, meet Mariko Tamaki. So, who, if you don't know her work, like, run, stop, pause this and run out and go read everything she's ever written. But she makes some of the best graphic novels with her cousin, who's also, like, maybe, like, in my opinion, the two of them together are the apex of the form. Jillian and Mariko Tamaki, they did this one summer. They did this incredible book called Skim. They've done all kinds of things together. And, like, everything they touch together wins every award that it could because it's just always so fantastic. But Mariko is largely the writer. And so she let me audit a comics making course that she was teaching at U of T. So I just got to like sit in on it. And I was just working at a bike store at the time and they let me like take the week off so I could do this. Like I was willing to ask for this like latitude to just do this little thing. And it's so funny when these kind of coincidental moments that feel a bit like kismet-y happen.
Yes.
Because the waters really part for them if you're willing to just like ask a little bit. I asked my boss. He said, sure. I was able to do it. I sat in. And at the end of it, Mariko was like, do you want to come and do a few small collaborative comics with me? So I did a couple of short form pieces with her. One for a magazine. One was for The Walrus, which is like an online Canadian magazine. And as a result, I suddenly had publishing credits that I didn't have before, which in like by design of Mariko as an incredible friend and mentor, now I was eligible to apply for a bunch of Canadian grants that exist specifically for comics. So she was like, go do this, would send me links. Like, this is the essence of excellent mentorship, is just like very casually putting opportunity in my path and like giving me a little shove. So I always try to make an effort to like shove friends towards similar avenues because it's so significant to have somebody be like, you need to know there's an opportunity that fits your skill set and I'm going to show you how to get there. I'm going to send you the links. I'm going to like explain it to you because expecting people to just know or do that research out of nowhere, who's doing that? We're all like scrabbling to survive. Who has the time to be like, I'd like to advance my career in this specific way that I haven't even heard of? Like, are you doing speculative research? How would you know? Like, so that was such a huge gift. And I was very lucky because everything that I applied for, I got. So suddenly I had money coming my way. And there's nothing that validates an idea like financial remuneration. Like, unfortunately,
because it's acknowledgement too. They accepted your application. They chose you.
Exactly right.
And your project idea.
That's right. It's you know, like winning a vaguely merit-based lottery. It's like, I'd like to think it's very merit-based, but, you know, everything's nuanced. Still, so I don't want to be too flagrante about it, but...
Like, sometimes it is. Like, there's always the element of luck, too, isn't it?
Absolutely.
With art making and who sees something when.
Well, and, like, who applied at the same time you did? If, like, 8 people who are better than you would have done it, they would have got it. But when I applied, I was in the top portion of the heap. So it totally worked out. Luck absolutely was a big piece of it, and I can't discount that. So,
and drive.
Well, yeah, it was significant. At the time, by the time I actually applied for this, I had quit my job at the bike store and was trying to be an illustrator full time. So I did give myself the leeway to, you know, sort of like, you have to swim or you'll sink. Which I don't mean that prescriptively. Having an extra job or being able to work full time, like, you need to be able to pay your bills. So I don't want to undercut people who have to work while they try to, you know, forge a creative career. I did for years. I mean, I spent my whole 20s not doing art at all, basically. I got super disillusioned by going to, like, art school right out of high school, and then just took like a decade to work. So it's, I don't want to paint a picture.
And kind of work through the disillusionment too.
Oh, yeah.
Not just to make ends meet, but
totally.
Both things.
Absolutely. It can be hard, especially, like, I was pretty sheltered as a kid, and going straight into university out of high school, you're sort of like, well, I'm good at drawing. What directions are there for me? And I think maybe kids now are more aware of what's available to them, but, like, this is a sort of pre-internet space, actually. When I graduated high school, like, I didn't get my first email address till I was in university, just to, like, put a timestamp on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it meant that, like, that access to information just wasn't there. Kids now are so much more aware of what's available to them simply because of, like, social media putting things on your plate, let alone, you know, the internet and your capacity to do your own research. So yeah, I felt like art school was the thing to do, but I didn't identify with contemporary art making at all. So it was like, well, where does this leave me? And in the city that I grew up in, which is Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, woo, which is a song.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out Saskatoon, which is really a beautiful city. And the University of Saskatchewan, which is there, is stunning and often plays Harvard in movies because it's...
So beautiful,
cheap.
Too.
Yeah, it's beautiful and it's cheap to make movies in Canada. So anyway... All that to say, there was nothing wrong with the school, but it didn't have programs that suited what I was looking to do. And so I worked for a lot of years. And that was a good thing, too. I don't regret it. Because now I have so much more life experience and different weird jobs and met so many different, like, oddballs that have nothing to do with the, like the bubble of art making. Yeah. That, you know, like, these are characters that become your characters in your book. These are the richness of your world. This is the broader understanding of how the world operates, as opposed to just, like, staying in an academic bubble for 25 years actually doesn't give you a sense of, like, you know, why things happen, why people vote the way they do, the why people make the choices they do. Like, I think it's actually kind of important to meet other people. And
yes,
that put me in that path.
But we can take a short break. We'll take a short break. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Jillian Gertz is here. Shirley and Jamila saved their summer. We'll be back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, Jillian Gertz is here in the studio. It's winter 2025, and Jason's behind the glass playing the songs for us. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. Keeping us on track, too. Thank you, JAV. And updating the Living Writers website. So this is also, they can't give enough kudos and thanks to Jason and to Jillian.
Hi.
To Jillian Gertz. This has been, I have loved this. We've got a few minutes left together, so let's just jump back into it.
Absolutely.
Because we did talk about how this is a graphic novel that we've got on the table with us, and it's hard to do like a reading from it.
Virtually impossible.
I mean, we could, I could be describing the panels as you're reading through, because the writing is good. I mean, it stands alone, but no, it doesn't, because it's the necessity of interplay of text and image.
Yeah.
I totally retract that comment. I was trying to be,
but I know what you mean. It's like the writing needs to support the story enough with the pictures. They're like, it's a two-legged table, which doesn't make any sense because that would fall over.
Well, they each have two legs.
Yeah. Yes. There you go.
That's right.
There you go.
Or on some panels, sometimes the visual is doing more.
Yep.
And so if we can trade the legs around. I don't know if we need this analogy to go on.
No, I think
anymore.
We should definitely spend the rest of the time just filling out the analogy.
Right, exactly. So valuable to do.
Oh,
just
yeah,
to keep,
absolutely.
To show our doggedness, our persistence. Okay. So we've talked about sort of the origin story of Shirley Bones, one of the two main characters of your Shirley and Jamila series. How did Jamila come to you?
Oh, that's
how, best friend. Well, yeah.
This is a great question. Jamila, she's just, I love her so much. And she's inspired by sort of a combo of two people that I met around the time that this idea was percolating. So I was taking a stand-up comedy class with this person who's actually also like a pretty lauded writer now, but wasn't at the time. Since then, they've gone on to write a memoir that was like a huge hit in Canada and like maybe elsewhere. I never know what's big anywhere else, but Samra Habib is the author, and their book, We've Always Been Here, is like a queer Muslim memoir. And also the stand-up comedian Sabrina Jaliz, who is Canadian but has since moved to LA and is kind of making a name for herself there. So these were two like super funny Pakistani Canadians that I like had in my eye line. I think I met Sabrina one time, but like I don't know that she knows who I am and vice versa. Like I don't know her well, but they both were so funny and like grounded and had like a lot of, I don't know, an energy that I was like, this is a great, like, also like a really Toronto character. Like, even though Sabrina left and like Samra's still there, they both had like this Torontonian energy where they'd both kind of like come up in the area and had parents who'd immigrated to Toronto from Pakistan. And it just like, there was something about that that seemed like that was the other character that I wanted. And Samra let me interview them and gave me like very generously a bunch of their life story that I could at least like seed the background of the character with. So it was like Toronto, as we discussed, is the most multicultural city in the world. So it
and
Shirley
Bones presents as a white girl.
Yeah. Well, and my thought with Shirley was that, and my thought still is that her parents are also immigrants from England. Like, I think her parents are British, bringing in that sort of, like, Arthur Conan Doyle energy. Except that, you know, in the true racist fashion, we call white people who move from country to country expats instead of immigrants. So, you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
They're immigrants, too.
Everyone is immigrants.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, it's, I wanted that element to be present. And I also knew I was facing the challenge of being a white person myself writing characters of color. So thankfully my editor and agent are both not white. At the time, I've switched editors a few times, like just that's how the cookies crumbled, not because I had any, like the switches of editor were not my choice, and every editor's been amazing. It's been very lucky. But I picked my agent with some intention around that, because I wanted her to check me. And my editor Namrata Tripathi, who's amazing and started an imprint at Penguin called Coquila that's specifically for like writers of color, that's like kid oriented. It's amazing. She was my first editor, and like she very much auditioned me when I was, you know, maybe going to get a book deal with them, and like was absolutely testing me for white fragility. And I'm like, please let me pass this test. And I mean, thankfully, she found me not wanting and was willing to work with me going forward and gave me the most amazing feedback. And I also paid cultural sensitivity readers to read the book and give me feedback and like just make sure that I wasn't falling into traps or I wasn't, you know, leaning on stereotypes or doing anything. But I also felt that it's important to represent the city as it is. And my Toronto is very multicultural. And my Toronto. I mean the Toronto. When I say that, I don't mean that I own the city. I mean that, like, the experience of my world there was just not all white people. So I wanted that to be represented. And I thought that was a nice counterbalance, too, to how absolutely white and racist the original Sherlock Holmes books were. I mean, I also didn't want this to be like, I'm Sherlock Holmes with a kid hat on. The references are there for anybody who wants to find them.
Oh, so okay.
But I didn't want to beat it over the head either.
Could you give an example of that? Like, do you mean the trench coat or the...
The trench coat. I mean, Sherlock Holmes nerds are going to find out like, oh, like Jameela Waheed and John Watson share the same initials. Like,
oh, yes.
Little like nerd Easter eggs. And I borrowed loosely from... the like the plot layout of A Study in Scarlet, which is the first Sherlock Holmes book where Watson and Sherlock meet. So I was like, the bones are there. Bones. But it's like two people who meet and become friends out of convenience rather than like initial, you know.
The attraction to each other as friends. Like seeing, recognizing something in the other.
That's
it grew. And that's what you do here too.
Yeah.
You show us. And also love that there's like conflict, there's a fight because they aren't like the people who would maybe naturally be drawn to each other.
Yep.
Because of, you know, Shirley Bones, for example, wants to be in her head and work alone, and Jameela is like, hey, I'm here, I'm not just a means to an end to stay and walk around.
Well, and the idea that like until sort of the, you know, emotional climax of the book, they're having a power struggle about whether they even are friends or not and like who's in charge. And, you know, Shirley's required to be vulnerable and meet Jameela where she's at in order to move forward. And like from that point on, they see each other as equals and, you know, are going to actually have conversations about how involved or not involved everybody wants to be in mystery solving. And like Jameela enjoys the solving of mysteries and wants to get on board with Shirley's stuff, but doesn't want to do so as a second class citizen or as a sidekick. So, you know, having to have these vulnerabilities, I think was really important to make them equals. And Shirley needs to be have a moment where she's forced to be vulnerable and admit that like this new person who's come into her life brings her something. And if she's not going to be willing to be flexible, she will lose that. Is it worth it to lose it and stay stubborn? Or are you willing to flex to like allow your life to
and change as a person?
That's right.
And as a way of seeing yourself too.
Totally.
So that's a departure from Sherlock Holmes. Like that's a clear departure.
Totally. I mean, there's like drips and drabs of it in Sherlock in terms of like sometimes Sherlock shows a little vulnerability and Watson's just like sniffing around for breadcrumbs that Sherlock cares at all, which I wanted more than that for sure. Otherwise, why would like a modern kid stay with a friend who's such a jerk?
And you see it early on, I think, because there's a moment where Jameela gets to ask follow-up questions of a little kid, a six-year-old at a daycare, Sarah.
Yeah.
And Shirley seems to have been done with her questioning and she's getting answers and information via a bag of candy with this little kid, but then seems ready to leave. But Jameela has a great follow-up. What about the Chompo bar?
Yeah.
Once you read this, everyone, you're going to know what we're talking about. So Shirley and Jameela save their summer.
Yeah.
But so I thought that was so smart of you to have that moment where we see Jameela deciding, oh, I do want in on this detective work.
Yeah.
This is something I like and can do too.
Totally. It's I tried to give her a few moments where you can really see her buying in willingly by her own choice to a different path than she's used to being on, and also one that like breaks a lot of rules. I'd argue that some of that is there in the original material, but there's a lot. There's
in
sort
the
of
original
a sub,
Sherlock Holmes? Or?
Yeah. That there's sort of sub-themes of restorative justice, which is something that I, like, is sort of, for me, like, a quiet theme in this book. That, you know, being super punitive is not going to help anybody. And the idea that if everybody actually has a conversation together, that, you know, somebody who maybe did something that was bad has a redemption path.
That's
and, like, has
arc.
Their own story. And everybody has their own motivations for doing things.
And you begin with Kumi. You begin with Kumi early on, like the quick assumption. Well, if you've got the bag, you've got the gecko.
Yeah,
you meant
right?
to take it.
There's a stolen gecko, by the way.
Yes. There's so many good things.
Yeah.
But you do that.
Yeah.
And then do you want to say briefly the last panel about like a visual that you end on? It's pretty wordless. The last three.
It's very wordless.
Three panels.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is that at the end, Shirley sort of realizes the value of having friendship, that friendship is an enriching piece of her world. And you end with all of the characters. This is a real spoiler for a comic book designed for 8 to 12 year olds.
So turn this part off if you're driving and you've got.
But like they all end up being spending time together. You know, in the end, and playing together, which, oh, thank you. They're getting the 1 minute mark here. It's, you don't have to be best friends with someone who's hurt you down the line, but I like the idea that, you know, hurt people hurt people. If we don't have compassion for people who make, you know, choices that might hurt somebody, there's no path for restorative justice. And like, there needs to be a room. There needs to be room for people to tell their own stories. And in that way, you can decide, like, if you want to forgive, if you want to re-engage in friendship, if you want to whatever, you know?
Thanks for telling these stories.
Yeah.
And I hope there's a book three coming out.
There is. It's taking forever and going poorly. Writing is hard.
On that note, you've been listening to Living Writers. Thank you so much for talking today with me and with all of and all of us. Thanks to you, everyone out there, for listening. Jillian Gertz, The Books on the Table, Shirley and Jamila Save Their Summer, and Shirley and Jamila's Big Fall, third book, is going to be on its way into the world. Thanks for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Now, from WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, an hour of programming randomly selected from our archive.
You make me feel like dancing!
I want to dance the night away!
What the hell are you two doing?
It's called rocking out!
You wouldn't understand, Dad. You're not with it.
I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what I'm with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to me.
It'll happen to you.
No way, man. We're gonna keep on rocking forever. 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 Forever.
You're listening to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor.
It is true, you are listening to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. It's also true that if you continue listening to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, you will remain hip forever. It's a veritable fountain of youth down here in the basement of the Student Activities Building on the University of Michigan campus. Who am I? I'm DJ Nash. This is The Abstract Truth. Normally at this hour, you'd be hearing the voice of DJ Samizdat about to bring you a full hour of truth. However, this week, Samizdat is on assignment, checking out a new printing press. Therefore, it falls to me to bring you the encoded messages of this week's show. Just check your decoder ring. It'll be on a different channel. Behind me, you hear Brian Eno from the album Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks. It's the track Under Stars 2. We're going to hear this for just another few seconds, half a minute or so. Then we'll continue on with the rest of the program today. Just stay tuned.